In 1966, in the sleepy town of Oudendalsrus in the Free State, two 12-year-old girls, cousins Isifori and Petronelle, are kidnapped and murdered. Issy's brother vows to leave no stone unturned in his quest for justice for his sister and cousin. And although it would take more than 20 years, he kept that promise. But the fallout of the brutal murders would take its toll regardless, and the families and communities involved would never be the same. In a brand new drama series based on these true crime events, CakeNet explores this case in the series Nichies. A new episode of Nichies airs every Tuesday on CakeNet, DSTV channel 144 at 8 p.m. and you can catch up with any episodes you've missed on DSTV Stream and Catch Up. Darkness is settling over the small fishing town as a scream cuts through the roar of the sea. Within minutes, the woman is silenced, but the killer is not finished. He moves into the shadows, searching for his next victim. This is True Crime South Africa. I'm Nicole Engelbrecht, and you're listening to episode 183, Spree Killer, Koos Samson. This episode is sponsored by The Bed Store. Is your bed holding you back from the best sleep ever? The Bed Store offers a variety of bed sets and mattresses from trusted brands like Sealy, 40 Winks, and Restonic. With 23 stores across Gauteng and KZN and an online shop, finding your dream bed has never been easier. Visit www.thebedstore.co.za and give your bed the upgrade it deserves. Since 2019, True Crime South Africa has been telling the stories of the victims of violent crime in South Africa. The podcast is independent. That means no big or even little corporates fund it. And that's just the way I like it. And it's the only independent podcast in South Africa that consistently charts in the top 10. Keeping a podcast like this going is time-consuming. And for the most part, it remains a one-woman process. It's me. I'm the one woman. You, yes, you, are the reason this podcast continues to flourish and help bring in tips on missing person and cold cases. If you'd like to help keep the show running, please consider supporting our sponsors, signing up to Patreon or PayPal, follow the show on the socials, as the kids say, and share it with your fellow partners in crime. You can find our social links and learn more about our sponsors at truecrimesouthafrica.com/donate. Shout out to this week's Patreon and PayPal superstars. A huge thank you goes out to Latricia Carlson, Bronwyn Reynolds, Lisa Kotick, Jean Davis, Angelique Smith, and Tanya, for your support on Patreon. Thank you so much, everyone. Your support really does make a huge difference. Patreon supporters get one additional exclusive episode a month, a shout out on the pod, and other exclusive content, including Q&As with me as and when it's available. It's a minimum of $1 a month. I think you should do it. Please. And thank you. Kia ba. Today's episode was first published in the True Crime South Africa Patreon feed in January 2024. This case is a relatively rare example of a spree killer, which is different in definition and criminologically to a serial killer and mass murderer. Although you sometimes hear the terms serial killer and spree killer used interchangeably, they are in fact two distinctly different crimes, and the psychology behind them is different too. I think the confusion comes in when people refer to a criminal's multiple crimes as a crime spree. The difference in definitions between a mass murderer, serial murderer, and spree murderer are as follows. A mass murder occurs when an offender kills multiple victims in a single location on a single occasion. A South African example would be the Sizzlers massacre. A serial murder occurs when two or more victims are killed at different times at different locations, often with a cooling-off period in between. And a spree murder is when multiple victims are killed at different locations at different times, but not with a long enough period in between the crimes that it could be considered serial murder. So, for example, a serial murderer will usually have many days, weeks, months, or even years between crimes, while a spree killer's crimes are usually separated by either minutes or hours. The motives for spree murders are also quite different from serial murder, in that serial murder motives are usually intrinsic and deeply psychological, while spree murders are often ideological, revenge-based, or financial in nature. Long-time listeners of the show would have heard me mention the website SAFLEE quite often. SAFLEE is a project run by the Department of Public Law at the University of Cape Town and provides free access to judgments, case law, and related documents. It's really a little treasure trove, and often while searching for something specific, I'll stumble upon a completely unrelated case, which is super interesting. And I probably would never have known about it if it wasn't for me just randomly coming across it. And that's how I found today's case, which dates back to 1986. Of course, there are no other resources related to it, but I think you'll find it interesting, as I did, to see how spree killers and mental health conditions were dealt with in the era when we still had the death penalty in place for murders. In researching this episode, I used the judgments and sentencing documents from the case, as well as several academic resources. So, let's get into episode 183. Spree Killer, Chris Sampson.
The following episode may contain sensitive material, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, or graphic descriptions of injuries to victims. If you feel you may be triggered by such material, please consider this before accessing our content. To access trauma counseling or services, please see the helpline information on our show notes.
Lamberts Bay is a tiny little village on the west coast of the Western Cape province. I visited there a few times, and it's really the veritable one-horse town. When I was there, it had no traffic lights, only stop streets. Like many small South African towns and villages, it was built around a specific resource, which has changed over time. Lamberts Bay is named after Admiral Lambert, who was a British navyman who did a marine survey of the bay between 1826 and 1840. In 1887, one Mr. Stephen bought the commercial buildings and built a hotel the following year. The town's main function was as a place for British warships to dock during the Boer War between 1900 and 1902. After that, the town revolved around fishing and crayfish, and today is still a well-known crayfish destination, despite the catching of crayfish now being restricted due to overfishing. The first crayfish factory built in the area was built in 1918. Today the town is populated mainly by people whose families have lived there for many generations, or those who've retired to live in the area. Its population, as at the 2011 census, was 6,120 people. 75% of those occupants are people who identify as coloured. 90% of the inhabitants of Lambert's Bay speak Afrikaans as their home language. And I can attest to this because I was on holiday there in December 2004 when a tsunami hit Thailand. I was staying in a very isolated spot on the beach and heard about the terrible tragedy on the radio, so wanted to get more information. I drove into town, which is pretty much one street with a spa, a small cafe, and a butcher, and the obligatory bottle store. And do you think I could find an English newspaper? In fact, every time I inquired as to whether they sold English newspapers, I was looked at as though I were an alien that had just landed from Mars in the middle of their shop. Needless to say, I bought an Afrikaans newspaper. So yes, Lambert's Bay is where you go if you really want to cut off from the outside world. And although we now have all the news we need on our phones, make sure you can at least make do in Afrikaans. It is in this little fishing town, in 1985, that the case I'm covering today happened. Koos Albertus Samson was born on the 24th of October 1966. He grew up in Lambert's Bay, and although it was uncommon at that time in history for most people who didn't intend studying further to actually finish school, Koos did complete grade 11 before leaving. Looking at his behaviour in his teens, it's surprising that he managed to complete as much of his schooling as he did. In 1983 and 1984, when Koos was 16 and 17, he was found guilty of assault with intent to do grievous bodily harm. The two separate incidents involved Koos attacking friends with a knife on one occasion and a brick on the other. His father would later say that the young man had reacted abnormally to situations in which he didn't get his own way his entire life. He seemed to feel that his needs and desires far superseded others, and if he didn't get what he wanted, he would fly into a rage. As a child, this was merely a nuisance to his parents, who attempted to discipline the behaviour out of him, as most parents in that era would. Nothing changed, though, and as Koos got older and stronger, he became more and more dangerous. In addition to his violent behaviour, Koos also began to drink alcohol to excess. This was not uncommon behaviour in the community he lived in, where many people had alcohol misuse issues. But a drunken Koos was far more unpredictable than a sober Koos. And both his parents soon became quite afraid of him. Koos's extended family and most of his neighbours also wanted very little to do with the young man. His poor behaviour and outbursts had ostracised him from many, and although he referred to several people in the neighbourhood as his friends, those individuals, when asked, did not consider themselves his friends. They simply tolerated him a little more than others did. When Koos was found guilty of the assault crimes as a teen, he was given a common punishment for minor offenders at the time, lashings. Lashings, or flogging, was used across the world at one point as a punishment for certain crimes. Often the lashings were carried out in public, which was thought to serve as a deterrent for other possible offenders. I've covered quite a few cases on this podcast where an offender was given lashings as punishment for crimes as a minor. Considering I was covering crimes committed by those offenders, clearly it didn't serve as a deterrent in their personal case, but I did wonder how effective it was overall. Although I couldn't find any South African studies on the efficacy of corporal punishment for offenders, there was one study done in Scotland and England. That study compared offenders who'd received corporal punishments to those who'd received other forms of punishments for their crimes, such as imprisonment. And there was no significant difference in the levels of recidivism between the two groups. they'd reoffended at the same rates as one another. The researchers then also took a group of men who'd been convicted of robbery and all received flogging as their punishments. They divided them along the lines of previous convictions, whether or not the individual was a first-time offender. And it was found that first-time offenders who were flogged were found to have a far lower recidivism rate than repeat offenders who were flogged. And I think this makes complete sense. Whether or not corporal punishment is morally right aside, it seems to me that once someone, minor or not, has committed the same offence twice, clearly the previous method of punishment has done nothing to deter them. Of course, this is a simplistic view, because recidivism has a lot more to it than just how an offender was punished. If you take a street child, for instance, and flog him for stealing, and then put him back on the street in the exact same circumstances with no support, there's a damn good chance he's going to reoffend. Kuss, though, was not a child living on the street. His family was certainly not well off, but he had everything he needed. He was given access to education, and his parents did what they thought was best to correct his behaviour, and likely thought at the time that the corporal punishment given to him by the judicial system was the best thing for him. But it would have absolutely no impact, at least not a positive one. On the 24th of October 1985, Kuss turned 19. It was his last year of being a teenager, and he celebrated it by getting very drunk and passing out. The next day he woke, worse for wear, and spent the day doing some chores around the house until he decided to start drinking again. Around 9 p.m. that night, Kuss's cousin, Kathleen Camphor, who lived next door, came to visit. She was there to see one of Kuss's other family members, and whenever she visited, things were always tense because the cousins had had a falling out some time before. Despite being the same age, the pair had never gotten along, and Kathleen regularly called Kuss out on his poor behaviour. Kuss, in turn, despised the young woman and did everything he could to make her life difficult. That night, as Kathleen sat chatting to one of Kuss's family members, he heard her talking in the next room and stormed in. He demanded that she leave, and she refused. They began to argue, and Kuss grabbed Kathleen's arm, seemingly to drag her out of the house. Kathleen fought back, trying to wrench herself from Kuss's grip, but he was too strong for her. He dragged her into the yard and toward a drum in which the family stored smoldering coals to refuel their stove. Kuss attempted to push Kathleen's head into the drum as the young woman screamed. Then, as she squirmed to get out of his grip, Kuss saw a piece of steel bedpost laying on the floor beside the drum. In one swift movement, he bent down, picked up the piece of metal and slammed it into Kathleen's head. The young woman didn't fall to the floor at the first blow and stumbled forward, falling into the entrance to the kitchen. Kuss stood over her and began to rain down blows on her head. While there were other people present in the house that night, there's no mention of anyone trying to intervene as Kuss pummeled Kathleen more than 15 times. The young woman stopped moving after the first few blows, and by the time Kuss stopped, her skull had been completely shattered, and she would die long before any assistance could arrive. Kuss let the bedpost fall to the ground beside Kathleen's body and walked out of the kitchen. Walking through the yard, he spotted an axe and picked it up, before heading off, without a word to anyone, into the night. 25-year-old Hendrik van Wyk was headed home from a party when Kuss Samson spotted him. The two men knew each other but were not particularly close. Hendrik, by all accounts, had had quite a bit to drink that night, and when Koos allegedly asked him if he had a cigarette, it's claimed Hendrik had mumbled something back that Koos took to be an insult. Within seconds, Koos was attacking the man with an axe. While Kathleen's injuries had been severe, Hendrik van Wyk would be unrecognizable after Koos had attacked him. He hacked at the man more than 18 times with the axe, long after he'd stopped moving, and Hendrik died on the scene from his injuries. With this murder, Koos Samson had essentially started what could be classified as a spree of murders. This differs from a mass murder in that the individuals are usually killed at different locations and with small gaps of time in between, during which the offender travels. Mass murders are ordinarily committed at one scene with no spaces of time between the murders. As Koos had stood over the body of Hendrik van Wyk, blood dripping from his axe, another resident of the area had been coming home. Peter Kampfer was distantly related to Koos. He came from the same family tree as Kathleen, just much further down the line away from having Koos as a direct cousin. As he came down the dark road, he was horrified to see a terrifying scene illuminated in the moonlight. Koos's attack on Hendrik was complete by the time he came across them, and he stood frozen to the spot until he understood what it was he was seeing. Peter wasn't about to take a single step closer to Koos with that bloodied axe in his hand, and for a moment he hoped he might be able to just back up and run away without being seen. But Koos seemed to sense him there and looked up, shouting with a smile on his face, "Peter, my brother." Even though Koos had a friendly expression on his face, the bloody axe in his hand and the mutilated young man lying on the ground at his feet meant Peter was not sticking around for a reunion. He turned on his heel and started to run in the opposite direction. Koos gave chase, screaming in Afrikaans, "Tonight, I'm going to hack you all to death." Peter ran as fast as he could, but Koos soon caught up to him. He swung the axe in his direction, and it missed his head by millimeters. Peter dodged to the side, and instead of continuing to run on the road, he took his chances and headed into the dense bush. To his relief, Koos did not follow. A few minutes later, though, Koos arrived at the home of Martha van Wyk. Martha, who was not related to Hendrik van Wyk, who Koos had just murdered, had a son who Koos had clashed with in the past, and as Koos arrived, it was this man's name he bellowed out repeatedly as he hammered on the door. Martha van Wyk was asleep and very unhappy to be so rudely awakened. She stumbled wearily to the front door and opened it to find Koos looking absolutely wild. Martha was stunned and immediately terrified at the look on his face. She would later say she didn't even notice the axe in his hand, but the expression he bore was more than enough to tell her she didn't want to interact with him anymore. The woman barked out that her son was not home and then slammed the door closed and locked it. Koos became enraged at this and began hacking at the woman's house with his axe. He went from window to window, smashing them as the terrified woman huddled inside. As Koos had been proceeding on his spree, the nearest SAPS office had been receiving a string of phone calls and visits from various residents about what the young man was up to in town. An officer had been dispatched to look for Koos, and as the young man decided he'd had enough of destroying Martha's house and set out back onto the road, presumably looking for his next victim, the SAPS van shone its headlights on him. At 10:30 p.m., after a 90-minute killing spree, Koos was handcuffed and detained. The events of that night shocked everyone in Lamberts Bay. The small town had its share of domestic violence murders or assaults resulting in murder after drunken brawls. But something like this was completely out of left field for the residents. The level of violence and injuries to the victims were almost unprecedented. And Koos immediately became the subject of frightening tales that would be told for decades to come among residents. Koos Samson did not deny having committed the murders. There were far too many eyewitnesses for him to do that. But he did claim that he was not in a competent mental state at the time of the crime. As a result, and also on the request of the magistrates, Koos was sent for a psychiatric assessment at Valkenburg Psychiatric Hospital. And after this was complete, although he was fit to stand trial, the defence viewed the report and decided to call the psychiatrist who had assessed Koos as a witness. Dr. Magner testified that he had determined Koos Samson to have what he called a psychopathic personality. Dr. Magner said that the three most prominent traits he'd seen in Koos, which had led his diagnosis, were his inability to empathize with others or consider the well-being of others as ever superseding his own, a tendency to react aggressively to situations which others would ordinarily not react in such a way to, and finally, that Koos was impulsive and had a lower ability to control his behavior than other people. Now, it's important to point out that today, these three traits alone would not result in what Dr. Magner called a significant psychopathic condition close to certification. Today, mental health practitioners use a scale of psychopathy, which essentially ranks the intensity of what we now know to be a personality disorder. While we do still rank impulsive behavior as one of the psychopathic traits, we definitely do not see this as causing the person to not be in control of their own behavior. As far as violence is concerned, we now also understand that while people who rank on the psychopathic scale can be violent, this is not a default setting for the personality disorder. Rather, we know that one of the more common psychopathic traits is manipulative behavior, which is far more insidious and less overt. Dr. Magner further stated that he believed Koos's psychopathy explained Kathleen's murder, because he would have felt provoked and threatened by her. I will admit, I got a serious victim-blaming feeling from this. Dr. Magner went on to say that Koos's alcohol consumption likely resulted in him continuing to kill that night, and all his other actions. The doctor believed that Koos would have stopped killing after Kathleen, but the alcohol had lowered his inhibitions to the point where he decided to continue on with his spree. When Koos was on trial in 1985, the death penalty was still in force, and the level of violence involved in these murders definitely made that a possibility for sentence. There was a significant belief, though, that due to his age and the psychiatrist's testimony about his mental health, that the judge would not pass down such a severe sentence. Koos Samson was found guilty of the murder of Kathleen Kampfer and Hendrik van Wyk. He was also found guilty of attempting to murder Pieter Kampfer and the destruction of property for the damage he'd done to Martha's home. It was the sentence for the two murders, though, that came as a surprise. The judge had decided that the mitigating factors presented by Dr. Magner did not weigh sufficiently against his duty to protect society from a person who he felt was a significant and ongoing threat. As a result, he decided that Koos Samson needed to be removed from society permanently, and he sentenced him to death. Now, Koos's actions had been cold-blooded and incredibly violent, but they also had not been premeditated. Today, very little weight would have been put in the psychopathic trait diagnosis because we have a better understanding of how personality disorders impact offenders and that they do not cause individuals to act without understanding what they're doing or to not have control of their actions. However, we also no longer have the death penalty on the table. And I do think that if we did still have it today, judges would likely have to put much more weight on aspects like personality disorders. Really, everything about this judgment comes under a different lens for me because we are talking about a death sentence. If we were talking about the difference between a life sentence and a sentence lower than that, I would say absolutely not. Personality disorders, youth, and alcohol consumption should not be taken into account. But I do find it harder to say that when I know that a 19-year-old is going to have a noose placed around his neck. Is that fair? I don't know. Kathleen Camphor was also only 19. Puss Sampson was not prepared to go down to the gallows without a fight, though, and his defense attorney immediately appealed the sentence. In March 1987, three Supreme Court judges reviewed the original court's decision. In considering all the evidence before it, the Supreme Court focused on the possibility of rehabilitation, which even according to Dr. Magna was rather low, but not impossible. They also considered Kurs's age and previous case law in which the death sentence had been set aside because of the age of the offender. Dr. Magna had acknowledged that for Kurs to have any possibility of rehabilitation, he would require ongoing and intense therapeutic programs. He did feel that such programs could be provided in prison. Dr. Magna did also feel that although Kurs was technically an adult, he was still quite immature in nature and in his thinking. At the time, it was quite rare for life sentences to be handed down. In many murder cases, judges would either find sufficient mitigation for a lower sentence, usually around 15 years, for instance, which we've seen in several other cases around this time, or they would decide that absolutely no mitigation was valid and they would hand down death. There were very few instances where the middle of the road was used and life imprisonment was given. In this case, though, the Supreme Court eventually decided that a death sentence was not fitting. The possibility, albeit very small, that Kurs could be treated, his young age, the fact that the murders were not planned, and his alcohol abuse on the night, all convinced the Supreme Court judges to set aside the death sentence and instead impose a life sentence on Kurs Sampson. Really old cases are not often uploaded to SAFI. When they are, it's because they represent a significant piece of case law or something that future judges, prosecutors, and defense lawyers could benefit from seeing. Although we'll likely never see the return of the death penalty in South Africa, simply because it would take significant changes to our constitution to achieve, I do think that this is a very interesting case in terms of the personality disorder consideration. I have had quite a few people question whether we should actually be considering personality disorders as more significant contributors to offending behavior. And I guess there's an argument for that. But I do think that the delineating line we currently have between what we consider mental health conditions that can cause an individual to not be responsible for their actions and those that do not is a pretty good line. About 70% of incarcerated individuals do have some form of personality disorder. So while we understand that some of the traits that often come with these disorders, impulsivity, antisocial behavior, manipulation, etc., can contribute to offending behavior, we also have to consider that there are far more people on the outside, living daily life, also living with traits of or full-on instances of these disorders, and they are not offending. They probably aren't living super healthy lives either, unless they're self-aware and actively working to curb the negative behaviors, but they aren't killing people that we know of. Kurt Sampson may not have premeditated the murders, but he did escalate. His earlier offenses with a knife and a brick should definitely have been taken more seriously than they were, but hindsight is always 20/20. Today, those offenses would not have attracted corporal punishment, but more likely he would have had to serve some sort of correction program, which included therapy. Whether or not that would have had a different outcome is impossible to say, but I certainly think it would have had a far greater likelihood of success. Dr. Magna testified that had Kurs have been identified earlier and had intensive therapy, his path may have been changed. And I'd like to think that could be true. But we also know that people with significant psychopathic traits do not actually do very well in therapy at all, because of their lack of insight into their own emotional landscape and their ability to manipulate. There is unfortunately no way to know how long Sampson served in prison or whether he has been released. If he is still alive, he would only be about 58 today. And there's been a lot of confusion around old life sentences and how they fit into the current parole system. So it's entirely possible that Sampson is no longer in prison. I don't know that I'll be visiting Lamberts Bay again anytime soon, but I do know that since I started this podcast, I can't seem to travel anywhere without thinking about the crimes that have happened in that place. And this one will be no different. Cases like this also make me think about all the stories we don't know. Over hundreds of years, there have been countless cases like this. Innumerable victims that we just have no idea lived or died at violent hands. It's a bit overwhelming if I think about the scale. But also, the thought gives me a little push to carry on finding these cases, to keep discovering the Kathleen Kamphers and the Hendrik van Wycks of the world, whose lives were ripped away and whose tales have simply disappeared into the annals of time. Kathleen Kamphers, Hendrik van Wyk. Rest gently. If you'd like to hear more victim-focused true crime content, please subscribe to True Crime South Africa on Spotify or the platform you're using to listen right now. If you're looking for something still related to real-life stories, but often with a more positive slant, you can check out my new podcast series, I Lived Through This. You can follow both podcasts on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, thank you for your support, and I'll chat to you soon.